I'm going to bring the Committee on Energy and Environment to order. And first up today on the agenda, we're going to have an informational session on the small-scale renewable tool that the Department of Energy developed for us this summer. So I'm going to open that informational session now and invite that panel up. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Assistant Director for Planning and Innovation at the Oregon Department of Energy.
And hey, with me, Andy?
Yes.
I got ahead of myself.
Okay.
And I had the expert prepare some remarks that I'd like him to give some context to what you'll be telling us next.
Wow. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the kind words. We are here today actually to talk quite a bit about renewables, small-scale renewable energy, community-based renewables, and what our gracious chair is referring to is over the course of the interim, a few of us got together to have kind of an casual work group to talk about the issue, and really the nexus for this conversation came out of our work in the February session under House Bill 1547. Which opened up a wide variety of issues, but one of them was related to small-scale renewables, and as particular as it relates to the RPS, Renewable Portfolio Standard, and really just trying to figure out where we are as a state on this issue. Are we close to compliance? Are we on a pathway to compliance? How do we measure if we're on a pathway to compliance? So we worked closely with our friends here at Oregon Department of Energy to try to put together an assessment, really, of what projects do we currently have within Oregon or do we have that are associated to the various utilities involved in the question? How do we quantify what counts, what doesn't count? It's quite an interesting little conversation to have. So over the course of the interim, we had probably half a dozen meetings. I forget how many exactly with utilities were present. Rep Helm participated, Rep Reardon. I think Rep Huffman also was there for a couple of times as well, just to try to understand better where we are in the state regarding the question of small-scale renewable energy. And what do we need to do going forward? What could we possibly do? How do we equate a value, let's just say, to small-scale renewable energy? Do we count it all the same? Where there's a community or an economic interest, do we look at that differently than a project that just simply produces energy? So there's a lot of things to be considered. We had a good conversation, and what comes out of that is, I think, what you're going to hear from Odo today. The presentation was something they put together for us and for our work group. But now we have a tool that we can use to really inform us about where we are statewide regarding small-scale renewable energy, and then the question is, where do we go from here? And that's where I think that as we get into the LCs we're going to be talking about later. There's some differing ideas on where we might go, but we look forward to the conversation. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Johnson.
Now, Andy, please go right ahead.
Thank you for that introduction, Representative Johnson. Again, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Assistant Director for Planning and Innovation at the Oregon Department of Energy. And with me today is Rob Del Mar, who is a Senior Policy Analyst at our department. And as Representative Johnson just said, we're here today to present some information about an analytical tool that Rob put together to help evaluate different compliance scenarios and options for small-scale community renewables. Just by way of background, small-scale community renewables are defined in statute as renewable energy resources such as wind or solar, which have a generating capacity of 20 megawatts or less, but also biomass generation of any capacity that also produces thermal energy for a secondary purpose, such as an industrial process heat. We've developed this tool at the request of stakeholders, as Representative Johnson was just describing, so that they could see the effect of different assumptions and policy options about how to calculate compliance with the small-scale community renewables provisions. I want to emphasize that the tool does not recommend any particular assumptions or options over others. It simply calculates what the effects are, so it was designed to be more of a what-if type of tool. Developing tools like this is one of the important roles of the Oregon Department of Energy, and it falls under our general responsibility to provide comprehensive and unbiased information and data to support the type of policy analysis and discussions that you'll be having. The tool was built based on data that was provided to us by PGE and Pacific Power, and it's able to evaluate options that stakeholders were considering last summer when we developed the tool. And in just a moment, I'll turn this over to Rob to describe the tool and kind of walk through and show you what it can do. But first, I just want to add a little bit to the context that Representative Johnson provided. So before the 2016 legislative session, we started work on a report to look at the status under the old community renewables provisions that existed at that time. And then in March, Senate Bill 1547 was adopted, and it made significant changes to the law. And that made our analysis obsolete, and we stopped working on it. But after that, we got together with stakeholders to discuss whether they would find some type of a modified analysis to be useful. And so during our first meeting, which was on May 18th in 2016, everyone in the room agreed that the best approach would be if we built a tool that would allow questions to be asked on a what-if basis. So if we interpreted a provision this way, what would the result be? If we considered this option, what would the result be? And during the next 2 months, we began to collect data and build the tool. As I mentioned, PGE and Pacific Power provided the input data for the tool. And in late July, we were asked to demonstrate the tool for the legislative work group that Representative Johnson led, and as he mentioned, that Representatives Huffman, Helm, and Reardon were also participating in. And the work group then asked us to modify the tool so it could test additional questions. We worked on that for a while, and then in August, we presented the tool again to the original group of stakeholders that we'd been working with, and got some additional input and additional questions from them. So Rob continued working on the tool in September and incorporated all that feedback and then developed the tool that we have today. On September 22nd, Rob and I presented the tool to the House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment, and we haven't made any changes to it since then. So this is just a quick review of the original community renewables provision that existed before the 2016 session and the law that we have today. And the reason I'm showing this is that we built the tool really to look at the differences and analyze the effects. And in particular, well, you can't really see it on this slide, but some of the words on that slide are bolded. And hopefully on the copy on your laptops, you can see that. Those were some of the words that we were particularly interested in having the tool help us analyze, so that if you interpreted the word to, you know, one way or another, it would give you a different result for where we are in terms of meeting our community renewables. So the tool is able to help with those kind of questions. So looking at the primary differences after Senate Bill 1547 was adopted, the basis for calculating the level of small-scale community renewables was changed from retail load to aggregate electrical capacity. So rather than looking at the percentage of electricity that was generated by small-scale community renewables over a year, now under the current statute, we calculate the percentage of utilities' maximum output that could come from these facilities. So it's a very different calculation than what we would have done before. Second, the bill changed the provision from a goal for the state as a whole into a target that specifically applies to PGE and Pacific Power. Mm-hmm. And third, the bill included biomass cogeneration facilities, but it didn't include them under the 20 megawatt facility cap that applies to all other renewables. So those were the primary differences. So this is a list of the scenarios that can be evaluated by the tool as it stands today. And I'll just briefly explain these scenarios, and then Rob will delve into them more as he walks you through the tool. The tool can exclude or include out-of-state facilities. That was one big question about whether they would be included or counted or not, so we can turn them on or off and see the difference. It can also include or exclude renewable energy facilities that can't be used to comply with a renewable portfolio standard. So a good example of that would be a facility that's under 20 megawatts, it's a renewable energy facility, but it was built before the RPS eligibility date. So the question, would it count towards the community renewables goal or not, could be turned on or off in this tool. So the tool can also include or exclude net metered facilities. These are rooftop solar systems that are on the customer side of the meter that can generate renewable energy, but also could be considered to be a reduction in load rather than a small-scale community renewable generation when you're looking at it from the utilities perspective. And the tool can include or exclude biomass cogen facilities that are larger than 20 megawatts. As Rob will show, currently we don't have any facilities that are larger than 20 megawatts, but of course we could in the future, so the tool can turn that on and off. And then speaking of the future facilities, the tool can also include or exclude facilities that are planned or under construction but are not yet built as of the end of 2015. So historically, many facilities that are planned actually aren't built, and then, of course, some facilities that are not planned as of now will be built. But at least looking at the list of facilities that are currently planned, the tool can say, turn them on, turn them off, are they built? And finally, the tool allows a comparison of the capacity approach that's under current law versus the annual generation approach that we had under the original statute. One interesting and complicating factor is that many of these scenarios actually interact with each other, and Rob will give you some good examples of that. So when you change one thing, it affects other things. And the database includes a very large number of facilities, so the analysis is, even though on the presentation of it seems simple, behind the scenes or under the hood, it's actually quite complex. And because of the interaction between these scenarios, the tool does require, you know, some technical background to correctly interpret the results. So now I'll turn this over to Rob, and he'll walk you through the actual tool, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Sorry, I thought it was already loaded up, but we'll get it fired up here. Thank you, Andy, and for the record, Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Rob Delmar. I'm a senior policy analyst with Oregon Department of Energy. What I'd like to do now is just give you kind of a brief tour of the tool itself, what it does, what's contained within it, in some cases what it does not do. I'd just like to start with an overview. You'll see down here along the bottom row, there's a number of different tabs down here. These can be generally divided into tabs that contain data and those that contain analysis tools. And again, the data was provided by PGE and Pacific Power for the benefit of this analysis. It was done on a short time frame. You can see that there's a lot of data in here behind the tool. There's hundreds of these facilities that were being evaluated for this analysis. I think the best spot would be to go to this scenario toggle first. This is where we start seeing some of the actual analysis that's being done within the tab. There's a number of options here that enable stakeholders to evaluate compliance towards the target based on the scenarios that we worked with the stakeholders to develop. Again, we'll just look at this one. We developed an analysis based on both utilities in aggregate, and then we did it individually for each utility so that you could evaluate progress towards the target for the state as a whole based on those utilities that have the compliance targets and how they're doing individually. And essentially, you can select or deselect different groups of facilities and see how it impacts progress towards the target. So if you want to say, how do the out-of-state facilities impact progress towards the goal, you can select or deselect that, and this tool will show you how that impacts progress towards the target. In some cases, you may deselect something, and you'll find that the numbers don't appear to add up, and that's because some of these facilities belong to more than one category. For example, net metered facilities have overlap with out-of-state facilities, so there are net metered facilities within Pacific Power's territory and other states. So there's overlap that's happening within this analysis that's taken into account in this analysis, so you can select or deselect those scenarios and see how each scenario impacts progress towards the target. Up here in yellow, we've got our assumptions for the actual aggregate capacity as it's stated in statute. These numbers came from the utility integrated resource plans, and we used the design, basically the peak demand from the utility as a proxy for that undefined term. So this is our scenario toggle tab. This is where you really have the full functionality to turn off and on different facility groups. Following our meeting in August, we had additional requests for more fields to analyze. That included looking at the goal not only on a capacity basis but an energy basis, also looking more closely at planned facilities, how planned facilities impacted progress towards the goal, and also to look not only at 2016 but also all the way out to 2025, which was the compliance year for the law. So based on that request, we developed this summary table tab. And what we have here is really just a slice through the data. We're not doing scenarios here anymore. There got to be enough complexity between 2016, 2025, capacity versus energy. I think that warrants a brief description. As the target is currently written, it's aggregate capacity, and capacity refers to the maximum instant output of a facility, and it's akin to, say, horsepower on an automobile, whereas energy is what's the electricity that's generated by that facility over the course of a year. So if you have a 1 megawatt facility, mm-hmm. that's the capacity. If that facility operates for an hour, it's generated a megawatt hour, and that's the unit of energy. So we're measuring now compliance towards both capacity and energy in this part of the tool. We also were looking at loads for 2016 and 2025, and again, our assumptions came from the integrated resource plans from the utilities. They were a great partner in this, providing data on a timely basis. I think to look at the summary tables, it's most useful to come down to Pacific Core, where we have the most scenarios to look at. Now you can basically just get a line item for each subgroup of facilities and see how it impacts progress towards the capacity target, or if it was reverted back to the energy target, how progress would be made on an energy basis, both for 2016 and 2025. Here you see the out-of-state facilities. This warrants note the facility list that we got from Pacific Power included facilities throughout the West, and those facilities are only contributing a portion of their output to Oregon loads. In this case, it's about 25%. That was a value that came from Pacific Power. And so this line of out-of-state facility is derated to 25% of the output for those facilities, just as a heads up. We also looked at their in-state existing capacity and their planned capacity, but these we created additional line items to show how it looks if you count their full capacity and not this derated capacity. So those numbers are in there. Again, we got additional data for planned facilities. That's pretty much it. If there's any questions about the operations of the tool, I'm happy to answer those.
Thank you so much. I'm going to open it up to questions in just a second, but I remember that the members of the informal work group, we had access to the tool and were able to play with it.
Right.
How would the public get a hold of this tool right now? And we were looking to see if we could find it on the website, if it's been posted, or is that possible?
It's not posted.
It's not posted, and this was It was really built for a select group. I don't know that the public would have much value for it. I think all of you may. It's got a certain target audience, and so it's not made with a really public interface.
So, Chair Helm, if I could just add to that, that you know, obviously it's a public record, and any member of the public that would like to have it is welcome to have it, but it wasn't designed to be very user-friendly because it was just put together as a tool for experts to play with. The interface would be difficult, and maybe interpreting it would be difficult, so people might get misleading results just looking at it. And it might be better if people had questions that posed them to us and we could help them to utilize the tool to get answers. But certainly anyone who would like to have a copy of the tool can have it.
What I'd like to make sure to do is make sure that the members of our committee all have access to it. And I'd also, before questions, like to thank PGE and PacifiCorp for cooperating in this project and working so closely with the department to provide the baseline data. And while some numbers come up as you click the different toggles. Remember, everybody that's tracking this, that those are assumptions, and so the numbers that come out are not exactly, you shouldn't take that as the truth necessarily. They are estimates, and this is a tool for making future policy decisions. But thanks again for providing that data, and we have a lot to work with now, and I appreciate that. Any questions from the committee?
I have one.
Representative Powers.
And this was just a point of clarity for me since I wasn't involved in previous discussions, is the biomass called out specifically here because of our conversations today, or because I noticed the other different types of renewable energy aren't?
Chair Helm, Representative Power. Biomass was called out because in Senate Bill 1547, biomass was counts as a community renewable, but it doesn't have the 20 megawatt cap that other renewables have. And so stakeholders were interested in finding out what the impact of that was. So we made a specific line for that so you could see if you included above 20 megawatt facilities, how it would affect the result, or if you took them out, how it would affect the result.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Bent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for all this work. That's a lot of work. Yeah. And I certainly understand, Mr. Chair, the admonition that you shared with us about not relying on any of it because there's so many variables up there. But at least you tried, and that's great. I think it's going to be a very interesting tool to look at and then ask a lot of questions about. So thanks for all the effort.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add some points in here, too, in that the investor owns provided a lot of good data, which helped to provide this tool up here. But the public's also provided information to the work group about projects that are in their jurisdictions of PUDs, municipals, and so forth. It was informational for the committee as we worked through this. They don't fall under the RPS, so they aren't directly involved in the conversation, but they also did provide some good information that helped us. But I guess my question would be to either one of you, as you look at the conclusions based on what we currently have, I mean, there are some different scenarios that you can look at. How do we look, how does Oregon look regarding compliance with the 8% as defined in Senate Bill 1547 as we look out towards 2025 and meeting those goals for the 8% of the 25% of the RPS? Either what's in process or currently under transmission or projected to be based on the testimony that we had from the IOUs.
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, just one caveat before I'm going to ask Rob to answer the question is that part of the reason we made the tool is that some of the terms that are in Senate Bill 1547 could be interpreted different ways, and depending on how you interpret them would significantly affect the answer to that question, and that's why we made the toggle. So answering the question has to be kind of contingent upon having an agreed set of assumptions about how these terms are going to be defined. But with that caveat, Rob, can you characterize under the capacity approach of the current law, where we are in terms of meeting the 8% goal?
Yeah, as far as a snapshot goes, Chair Helm, members of the committee, we do have a snapshot for where we are in 2016. I believe it's reasonably accurate. If you include all of the facilities under the various scenarios within 1547, we're currently somewhere between 5% and 6%. This is based on the capacity basis, which is currently in law. Again, there's a lot that happens between now and 2025, which is when the target is actually in statute. So with the summary tables where we try to project, you can go in here and certainly find scenarios with groups of facilities that add up to 8%. And in this case, it's not directly additive because there is overlap between the facilities, and the summary tabs don't back out the double counting. So it really gives you a chance to look at each scenario's, you know, impact on the target, whereas this scenario, this one does give us the ability to count just the without double counting. So, you know, according to the data that was provided, we certainly have excellent progress towards the target. We're not at 8% now, but the target is not until 2025. So,
thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Breschke.
Thank you for coming. My question is, as a software developer, how many people hours did this take to build the tool to where we're at today?
Chair Helm, representative, I would say this was somewhere around 20 hours worth of work to get this put together. It was several days, and it happened all at once. Yeah, somewhere in the 20 to 40 hours, I would say, is what it took to put this together.
So a work week for one person.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Very good. Well, thank you so much for explaining this to us, and really happy to have the tool for future use.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is it possible that we can get – thank you. Is it possible that we can get the presentation – because it's not in our meeting.
We're working. We're working on that. Very good. Folks, I'm going to change up the order of the hearing a little bit today because we've got several people that have traveled a distance to get here, and I want to get them back on the road home if they want to do that. So at this time, I'm going to close the informational hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2136. And I'm going to invite up Mark Thaliker, Judge Steve Schaefer, Brian Sheehan, and Les Perkins. And I'll let you organize yourselves.
We've allocated it.
Okay.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power, Vice Chair Johnson, and members of the House Energy and Environment Committee, thank you for having us today. I'm Gillum County Judge Steve Schaefer. I like to think of Gillum County as the renewable capital of Oregon. We have 1,100 megawatts of wind turbines in our county. We also have 13 megawatts of power being produced by Columbia Ridge Landfill. I also co-chair the Association of Oregon Counties Community and Economic Development and Emergency Preparedness and Resiliency Committees. I'm also on the executive board of the Community Renewable Energy Association and North Central Public Health District. I would first like to thank the 2016 legislature for including small-scale renewables in Senate Bill 1547. As adopted, current law requires 8% of the RPS renewable energy requirement be small-scale renewable energy projects by 2025. This was a major win for small-scale renewables in Oregon, and we thank many of you who were along with us for that not-so-easy journey. I'd like to think that Senate Bill 1547 laid the foundation and the framework, and House Bill 2136 will finish the House. Oregonians want renewable energy. They expect and need those projects to be local for both economic and resilient reasons. As there seems to be differences, the goal of House Bill 2136 is to help clarify what is a small-scale renewable energy project. We are here today to provide you with data and examples of what we consider to be small-scale energy projects and make our case for House Bill 2136. As you will hear about a couple of these small renewable energy projects, keep in mind that these will help diversify Oregon's energy portfolio. They'll improve Oregon's air quality and the health of the public, thereby the health of the public, and provide economic development opportunities. They'll also provide resiliency in the wake of a disaster, which we all need to consider today. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Hood River County Commissioner Les Perkins, who is also the manager of the Hood River Farmers Irrigation District, and Mark Villacker of the Three Sisters Irrigation District. Les.
Well, I'm grateful to go before Mark today. Mark's a frequent speaker here and elsewhere. So I've been a commissioner in Hood River County for 16 years, focusing mostly on energy and water issues. I've also developed renewable energy projects and irrigation infrastructure around the western U.S. for about the last decade. And for about a little over the last year, I've been the manager of Farmers Irrigation District.
Do we have a clicker to move the PowerPoint? Right here.
Les, while we're waiting, can I get you to identify yourself?
Oh, sorry. Les Perkins, Hood River County Commissioner and Manager of Farmers Irrigation District. I won't worry about the PowerPoint. So I'll give you a little bit of an overview of Hood River County. We are tied to water in pretty much every aspect of our economy. We have about 23,000 acres of farmland, irrigated farmland. The district that I manage has about 6,000 acres of that. We have one of the highest concentrations of aquatic ESA species in the state, which makes managing water resources quite challenging. I'm just giving you this background so you can think about the context with small-scale renewable energy projects. So in terms of the impacts to our local economy from small-scale renewable energy projects, our district has about 4.8 megawatts of nameplate capacity, but there's two districts in our county that have renewable energy within them. Both are hydro. Between the two irrigation districts, Middle Fork and Farmers, we generate about 50 million kilowatt hours a year of low-impact hydro, certified low-impact hydro. That equates to enough power for about 4,350 homes, or about a third of our residences in our county. Together, our two districts, we've both had hydro for about 30 years. We have derived about $100 million in revenue, and that revenue has gone back into our systems, 100% of it's gone back into our systems in the form of improvements to our irrigation systems. You can go forward. Good again. So some of the numbers that are on the screen, between the two of us, we've installed 98 miles of pipeline into what were once open canal systems. We've removed 30 passage barriers to fish. We've installed 11 fish screens, and we've conserved over 7.4 billion gallons of water annually. Go to the next one. So this photo shows high-efficiency irrigation systems. So one of the things that pressurized water does for an irrigation district is that it allows our farmers to put in these efficient systems. So these efficient systems do a few things. Well, number one, we're able to eliminate pumps. So we've taken 1,400 pumps offline in our system, individual pumps, which equates to a tremendous amount of power annually. The other thing it does is it allows farmers to put on just the right amount of water into their crops, so in what's called deficit irrigation. So you're basically putting on exactly what your crop needs. improves crop quality, yield, and more importantly, it decreases your inputs. So when you're putting the water on exactly where you need it and when you need it, you decrease the amount of fertilizer and pesticides that run off of the property and into waterways. So it has a big impact on water quality. And the other aspect of it is that it decreases labor costs. So when you get rid of the old hand line systems and put in these efficient irrigation systems, they're generally automated or you're just going out and turning on a valve. So it decreases the labor input cost for farmers.
Go ahead.
So on the security and reliability side, this is a picture of a project that we completed this last year. That's a, on the left side is a 30-year-old metal pipe that was losing somewhere between 2 and 3 CFS, cubic feet per second. We replaced it with fused high-density polyethylene pipe. It was a project that cost about $1.1 million, but we were able to put 1.5 CFS back in stream from that project. And so, and then also it eliminates the chances in the winter when we're running water for hydro. We can have landslides. We have all kinds of issues that happen. We're way out in the woods. And so it has a major impact on water quality. We no longer have the threat of having sediment go into a fish-bearing stream. Go ahead. And on the local generation side, I just want to point out that without this type of generation, our districts could never put these types of infrastructure improvements in place. They're tremendously expensive. Like I said, it's been $100 million we've invested into our systems over 30 years, and there's just no way. We already have very expensive rates when you look at what we charge our farmers, and it doesn't even come close to covering the debt that we've incurred. We've taken on $20 million in debt to do these efficiency projects, and so there's no way that you can do that on the backs of your farmers. The other aspect of it is that it's distributed generation. So like I said, we have two of these projects in our county, produces about a third of what we need for our residences. And so from a resiliency standpoint, it has a major impact on our local economy. And eventually, potentially, we could be providing power to our local community in the form of a microgrid in the event of a natural disaster. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Helm. Representatives, I'm Mark Thalaker. I am the manager of Three Sisters Irrigation District, and we thank you for the opportunity to speak to everybody today. One of the things, as Les pointed out, go ahead and click the next, that you're going to see about small hydro in irrigation districts is it's not just about renewable energy. It's about Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act compliance. TSID over the last two decades has basically embarked upon a program to pipe the whole district. Prior to the piping in the late 90s, we dried the stream up for the last 100 years. Currently, PGE and the tribes are reintroducing salmon and steelhead, and historically, Whitechoose Creek, which feeds our district, has the ability to double the steelhead run in the Deschutes River, which would take the Deschutes from low viability to high viability and put it in compliance with the Columbia BIOP. So the effects of these projects go way beyond anything people ever imagined. So if you take a look at our district, we're about 3 years away from completing piping the whole system. And when we're done, we'll be generating about 4 million kilowatt hours. We'll be conserving 9 million kilowatt hours. We will have put in over 35 second feet permanently protected by Oregon Conserve Water Statute in the stream for steelhead and bull trout and Chinook salmon in perpetuity. Our farmers are now receiving 25% more water on farm. Currently, the 5,000 acres of the 7,500 that are receiving pressurized water are spending over $2 million annually in the local economy, additional inputs in purchasing irrigation equipment, raising seed crops, buying tractors, building farm buildings. And I just have to tell you that the last time steelhead and salmon ran through Sisters was 1895, before the farmers started irrigating. So, you know, bottom line, if we did not have these small hydros, we would have no ability to do the projects and to pay back the Clean Water Revolving Loan Funds. So we're very proud in TSID that we're generating renewable energy and helping
PacifiCorp and soon PGE with their RPS. But in addition to that, we're helping the community deal with ESA and Clean Water Act. And so ultimately, when you look at the Deschutes Basin, right now, because of the spotted frog and steelhead and bull trout, we are looking over the next 20 years to pipe all 1,500 miles of canals in the eight districts. We're talking about $1 billion of infrastructure and investment, and we're talking over 20 hydro plants in the larger districts like COID and North Unit and some of the other districts. These plants have the ability to potentially produce 25% of the cost of that $1 billion. This is something that folks need to focus on and pay attention, because if we were to wipe out the water going to North Unit Irrigation District, we would take out 85% of the world's carrot seed production. So this is serious stuff. And so we come here today in support of 1547 and also 2136, and we thank you for your help.
Thank you, Mark. Brian, you're next up, and I just wanted to mention, if you haven't found it on OLIS yet, this testimony is under submission by Amanda Dalton. So if you want to follow along with OLIS there.
Let's down a little bit. Okay, good afternoon. Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Brian Skain. I'm the Executive Director of the Community Renewable Energy Association, and appreciate you providing an opportunity to make this presentation today. But before I start, I'd like to give a little bit of a shout-out to Andy and Rob who work on the tool. That was one of those things that conceptually probably didn't seem like a lot of work, but when you begin to dig into it, it took a lot of effort. And the results have been, I think, informative to all of us, so I'd like to express my appreciation for that to start the testimony. So CREA is an interesting organization. It's organized under the Intergovernmental Statutes of Oregon, but it's also something of a public-private organization. We have members that are counties, irrigation districts, councils of government, small renewable project developers, profit and nonprofit businesses and organizations. And our fundamental mission is to support the development of small renewable resources, as Andy defined them in his presentation. One of the things I like to say is we are resource agnostic. We support the development of all forms and types of renewable energy as defined under Oregon law. So small hydro, wind, solar, geothermal, we like them all. I'm also here speaking on behalf of the Renewable Energy Coalition, an organization that we work very closely with in a number of areas, particularly in proceedings before the Oregon Public Utilities Commission. REC has a similar mission. Their membership is comprised pretty significantly of small hydro developers. So you can see that we've got a lot of synergies between the two organizations and work closely together. Like to take a little bit of time to kind of walk through the provisions of 2136. The objectives, as we see them, are multiple, starting and most significantly, perhaps, with the desire to promote diversity of resource types, sizes, and location. As I said, that is fundamental to CREA's mission. We want to see renewable energy of all types developed in a broad and geographically diverse means or methods that we can. We believe that doing so enhances the electric reliability in the event of a natural disaster. Having smaller projects close to load provides some ability to island a distribution system and provide generation to at least a limited area, hopefully to key, you know, facilities and buildings that would be used and necessary in the event of, you know, an event like the earthquake. Reduce the need for construction of new transmission by increasing generation close to load, you know, rather than having large generation somewhere significantly away from load and creating additional burdens on the transmission system. We believe that these smaller resources closer to load can help reduce some of the stresses that we are already seeing with the transmission system. There's been a lot of media coverage recently about some of the problems that the community of Prineville is having with trying to land a pretty significant employer for them due to transmission constraints on the BPA system that will make it difficult, if not impossible, to provide the energy that that customer needs. Renewable projects enhance air quality, public health, and reduce the need for larger multi-hundred thermal generation projects. The second thing is something that we think is important and was really kind of confusing coming out of last year's discussion with 1547. 2136, as we proposed, it changes the compliance calculation from aggregated capacity back to retail energy sales. That's the way it was in the initial RPS. That's the way that it is for the remainder of the RPS under 1547. This capacity calculation, I think added an element of confusion and uncertainty to what is already, in some cases, a uncertain and confusing situation. So we propose that we go back to an energy-based approach rather than this aggregate capacity. We wanted to clarify that the 8% community renewable obligation is not on top of the RPS obligation. It's part of it. So we're not talking of a stacking of 8% on top of 25%. That's subsumed within those calculations. One of the things that we've done, and to some degree it reflects the work that the Department of Energy did, is we actually are proposing to reduce the initial step from 8% to 6%. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of conversation with regards to the answer that to the question that Representative Johnson asked, which is, how are we doing? And the answer is sort of depends. I think from our perspective, we're a ways away, and in recognition of that, we propose to reduce the initial step from 8 to 6. Then we propose to increase it as the RPS steps up over time. Currently, 8% is roughly a third of the 25% 2025 obligation. So we propose that that ratio or that relationship of a third continue as we move to 50%, that a third of the renewable portfolio obligation be provided by these small 20-megawatt and under community projects. So the definition of what counts is undoubtedly going to be a significant part of the conversation. And we believe that good public policy is to start out with a definition that frankly defines renewable energy the way that the law defines renewable energy elsewhere. So if it qualifies for the RPS compliance, then it qualifies for the small community obligation. If it doesn't, then it would not. So we try to keep that consistent. The issue of cogeneration came up. I'd like to make clear that we support the solution to that that is in 2133, which we're going to discuss, my understanding, a little bit later today, which essentially allows 20 average megawatts worth of energy, again, keeping, sort of an apples-to-apples situation with regards to the utilization of energy, not capacity. So we support the inclusion of up to 20 average megawatts worth of energy out of a cogeneration, biomass cogeneration facility, irrespective of its capacity. So you could have a 35-megawatt project, and depending on how that operates, but up to 20 average megawatts of energy would be included. The projects need to be standalone. We understand that there's been, some history or at least some discussion about efforts of developers to game the system, and we recognize that. So we really don't want to have large facilities broken down into small projects of 20 megawatts or less. One of the things that's important to Cree and Rec's perspective is to encourage diverse local ownership of projects. And to do so, we would prohibit ownership of those projects by investor-owned utilities. We'd be happy to respond to that and questions that you may have. Our bill also would require a bundled delivery of energy. You could not strip green tags from the energy. Energy goes one place. Green tags from the projects go the other. For the small communities, we believe that a bundled delivery is appropriate. And again, I've said it a lot. We believe, and the bill promotes diversity of project development, a range of facilities, different resource types throughout the state. And the state of Oregon, as everybody knows, is somewhat diverse. Not every area has wind or has solar or has biomass, but in aggregate or in total, Oregon is uniquely blessed with the ability to have small community renewable resources of a variety of types. This issue is a little bit tricky, and I know that there's at least a couple lawyers on the committee, so let me try to explain what we're up against here. As much as we might like to require these small community resources to be built in Oregon, that pretty clearly will run afoul of the Interstate Commerce Clause issues associated with that particular clause of the Constitution. I'm somewhat familiar with this from my previous life. And we gave a lot of thought to what the appropriate answer to this question might be to encourage resources to be built, you know, in Oregon, but not necessarily mandate that in a way that would create a Commerce Clause question. So what we did is something that is comparable to what the state of California did when they passed their renewable portfolio standard. And essentially what it does is require these projects to be built in a balancing authority that is located in the state of Oregon. So what that effectively means is a project built in the Bonneville Power Administration, Balancing Authority, Idaho Power, Pacific Corp West, or Portland General, and any of those balancing authorities, which includes areas both within and without the state of Oregon, would be qualified for compliance for the small community portfolio. The bill directs the utilities to comply with provisions of this law as soon as practicable. We believe that the numbers show that we're not where we need to be yet, and probably have not been where I think the original RPS anticipated we would be when they established the goal. And it declares an emergency, and the reason that we included that is that our friends at the PUC are essentially kind of sitting on some rulemaking, pending some clarification that we believe this bill provides. Again, as Andy Ginsberg indicated, there's a lot of uncertainty with regards to just how various provisions are defined, and some legislative guidance through adoption of this legislation would provide, I think, much clearer direction for the PUC to then embark on rulemaking to implement the law. I do want to go back and touch base a little bit with this with regards to the question of where are we. I think that the department is correct. It really depends upon which you decide to include and not. Robert indicated in response to Representative Johnson's question, you know, the numbers in the 4-5%, and that's true if you throw everything but the kitchen sink at it. And as you might expect, there's probably some disagreement or perhaps agreement to disagree on just exactly what ought to be included in that. I think that as shown in the slide, what we call baseline capacity, those are the projects that I think everybody can clearly agree upon. And you can see the Portland General is at right at 2%, PAC about 1.25%. And then you go, you know, from there to a variety of other projects that are, I think, less clear with regards to whether they should count. You know, again, we believe that RPS eligible projects should be eligible, and if it's not, then it's not. And in some cases, that's a significant number, particularly for Pacific Corp and some of their old hydro projects. Again, the difference in energy and capacity is also significant. So you can see that this is an area that really does call out for some legislative direction. Okay. where we think that we probably are is represented in this slide. We think PGE is about 1.96, PAC is about 0.76. Under our proposal, non-RPS resources, of course, are not eligible for compliance. Out of state would be, provided they're in a balancing authority that does serve the state of Oregon. So again, Representative Johnson, that was a good question. It really speaks at a pretty significant part of this. And again, we think some legislative direction and clarification would be good. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Very good, thank you, committee. I've got about maybe 5 to 10 minutes for questions here, if we're going to get to the next panel and then also hear our other bill. So. Happy to entertain questions here, and if we need to, we can ask at least some Brian back for a follow-up in future sessions, so, or in future committee meetings, rather. Any questions right now?
Should I take that as a good sign?
Yeah, or bad sign.
This is the bad sign.
Please second that, Mr. Chair.
Riffle.
I'm trying to grasp the out-of-state projects within the specified balancing authority. You know, are there specific percentages that would apply, or is it of the amount of electricity generated or sold? That makes sense.
No.
See, I told you it was a bad sign. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how out-of-state projects come into this mix. I understand the Commerce Clause issue, but how are you scoring them, I guess?
So, for example, if you had a project, say, in Representative Bence's neighborhood that was in the Idaho Power Balancing Authority, that project would count towards compliance because that balancing authority of Idaho Power has customers' load within the state of Oregon.
But the project
could be built in Idaho.
That was my next question.
Yeah, the project
could project be in Idaho?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. A project could be built in the state of Washington if it was in the Bonneville Power Administration Balancing Authority.
Okay.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, I'll thank you. I'll thank you all for traveling. Safe travels back home. And let me just make a comment for the committee. I'm going to ask a question first and ask a comment. For Les and Mark, there's obviously a trade-off among your patrons between having the updated systems that you're providing and potentially paying a little bit higher rates for electricity to do so. What's your experience in how your patrons react to that trade-off? In other words, are they griping about high energy costs as
no.
a trade-off for getting what you're providing?
No, I mean our growers are we have the highest irrigation rates in the valley out of all the irrigation districts, and surprisingly we don't get a lot of griping about that. No, most of the growers who have been particularly with the district long enough to have experienced the times when we had open canals and couldn't actually deliver water for portions of the year, no, there's no griping because they're guaranteed their water and it is their livelihood. So I've never heard that, and in speaking with the previous managers, no, I've actually, we've had that conversation, and that hasn't come up with our growers.
Mark, and then I'll go to Brian.
So in the Deschutes, if you take the 8 districts in whole, one, having the surety of having water delivery, which the endangered species that are present right now threaten to create a situation that potentially could be similar to a Klamath where their water would be curtailed. Second of all, ultimately, this is one of those rare examples in the basin where if you install the infrastructure, you will solve the Endangered Species Act problem, which how long have we been fighting with the buy-up up in the Columbia? And Bonneville pumps almost $1 billion a year into that. So you have to look at things long-term. I don't expect to see ESA and CWA get revamped. We hope that we can get them applied in a more sane method. But that being said, as we've seen, ESA litigation can go decades. And so in terms of cost for higher electric bills, in our case, because we have gravity, we eliminated our farmers' electric bills, and that's one of the reasons they're spending the kind of monies they are in the local economy.
I mean, Representative Johnson has a question or comment there, and then I'll get to Brian, and then we'll wrap it up.
I'm really glad to have our folks from the irrigation districts present, because as we look, one of the questions that our work group pondered and so forth is how can we as a state incentivize these type of projects that have an enhanced community or and or environmental benefit to them, because not all small-scale renewables are alike. Apologies, Judge, but sometimes just putting a windmill in the backyard is not as beneficial to the large-scale community as a project that can create power and return those benefits back to the farmers, community, in a variety of ways. So as you look to the future, how many other potential locations or sites are there in the state of Oregon where this type of work could be accomplished? Do you have any? Just off the top of your head, I know you haven't prepared for that question.
Les could get into this in a lot of detail. We'll be here a very long time. But currently, Farmers Conservation Alliance, we have developed a tool where we're doing system improvement plans. And in the Deschutes Basin, we are in the process of completing all 8. And basically, a system improvement plan gives you a full hydraulic engineered model that allows you to go ahead and literally do the engineering on the whole irrigation district. The work that FCA is doing is amazing. We are also then working with NRCS on watershed and environmental assessment plans. And we are basically going to look to roll this out into the whole state. And FCA will be looking to do this in a number of other basins. And I would say that there is good, solid work in almost every river basin in the whole state.
And I'll throw one more, put my county hat back on. I think one thing to keep in mind is that counties are all struggling, just like the state, for revenues. And our county has looked at the potential for small-scale renewable energy projects within the county, and we've spec'd a 10-megawatt wind turbine project on county property, which I had the good fortune of taking out to the public and getting beaten severely for over visual issues. Anyway, we have all of the engineering done on that. It's sitting on a shelf. We've looked at solar capacity. We've looked at additional hydro capacity. We've been looking at biomass. So these are all things that we are keeping in our back pocket as a revenue source for us going into the future, because we don't have a lot of options in terms of being able to provide services and getting revenue to do that. And so it's not just hydro. There are others. So small-scale wind projects, small-scale biomass projects, small-scale solar projects, those are all tools in the county's toolboxes in terms of revenue sources.
Thanks.
Ryan, you want to wrap it up?
Yeah, thank you. And I would like to thank you for that question, because I think it provides me an opportunity to address something that's interesting. I find it interesting, having worked in a publicly owned utility for 30 years, 24 as a general manager. The business is changing, and it's changing fast. Yeah, I'm sure that those of you who were here for the 1547 discussion recall probably vividly a lot of discussion and debate with regards to, well, gee, how much would it cost to get to 50%? What is the rate impact? And some really smart folks working on some pretty sophisticated computer modeling for the investor-owned utilities came back with an answer. And I think that answer was much smaller than a lot of people would have thought going into that discussion. And that reflects the pretty significant reduction of particularly solar, but to some degree wind as well. So anticipating then the next question, okay, but conventional wisdom, economies of scale. Bigger is cheaper, right? And the answer to that question is not necessarily. The United States Department of Energy and the Lawrence Berkeley Lab has done some pretty significant research on that. And I came across with some numbers that were surprising, and I think they will be for you as well. Particularly with regards to solar, actually the median price of a 5 to 10 megawatt solar project is almost 20 cents less per watt than a 10 to 20 megawatt project, and 12 cents less per watt than a 20 to 100 megawatt project. And the most expensive projects at all are the projects that are 100 megawatts and above. So, and in the case of solar, the initial, you know, the initial take is that there's a diseconomies of scale, and there are some reasons for that. That comes out of a report, Utility Scale Solar 2015, Empirical Analysis of Project Cost, Performance, and Pricing Trends in the United States by U.S. DOE Contract and Lawrence Berkeley Lab. DOE also does and has done for a number of years similar analysis for wind. And going
Ryan,
back
me,
to 20-
Ryan, let me interrupt you.
Oh, yes.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Could we have the link to those studies you're
yes.
referring to? Because what you're describing now is exactly the opposite of what I understood was actually happening, and it would be useful to know that I've got it wrong.
Well, again, yeah, I think that it reflects some pretty remarkable changes in the business. So I brought these along and can provide those to staff or whoever. So
please do.
With regards to wind, again, USDOE does a similar Wind Technologies Market Report, and again, the numbers are a little counterintuitive. Projects greater than 5 and less than 20 megawatts were not significantly different in cost from larger projects. The average project in Oregon happens to be 100. So projects in the category of over 50 and less than 100 are only 10% less expensive than projects from 5 to 20. If you take all projects built across the country over the last 2 years, sure. The difference between a 5 to 10 or a 5 to 20 megawatt wind project is only about 12%. So there really is a slight economies of scale on wind and a slight diseconomies of scale. So if you kind of just roll that through back of the envelope, 50% RPS, our proposal is a third of the 50, about 60% of utilities cost is generation, and you've got, you know, a 10% difference in wind and roughly zero, if you will, on solar. And if you assume moving forward, you know, there's some relationship there, you're looking at, you know, percent rate impact. So, you know, Representative Barnard, I was also surprised. It goes against kind of conventional wisdom, but as we know, that's why people look at data and taking a look at it, it really does show, I think, a couple of things about the business that are changing. One is this business was predicated on, frankly, economies of scale, big coal plants, big nuclear plants, and the wind and solar business is beginning to change that. Frankly, it's also predicated on the assumption of, you know, what was essentially a natural monopoly. You know, and the whole regulatory scheme with regards to PUC regulation of a regulated natural monopoly, you know, with some public power competition got us to where we are when Congress adopted FERPA, and that injected some more into it. But, you know, this decreasing cost of these resources and the lack of significant differences in economies of scale is really a significant factor from our perspective. So I'm happy to share that information.
Thank you very much, all of you, and hope you have safe travels home.
Thank you. Thanks.
Going to invite next Annette Price, Varnish Seaman, John Charles, you here? Going to put you on this panel. I don't know what you're going to say, but put you here. And then Bob Jenks. Come on up. Okay, very good. I just want to recognize that we're we're a little over a half an hour from running out of time today, and I know that a couple of you may want to testify on the following bill. I want to get to that. I don't want to shortchange anybody on time here to respond to 2136, so help me juggle your time appropriately. John, you want to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit policy research center, and I've testified on the RPS back when it was Senate Bill 838 back in 2007 and its various progeny since then. And my testimony is on OLIS. You can find it if you look for it. My primary concern here is you're getting this increasingly more complicated. It's becoming sort of an elaborate monopoly board game that is, you're forgetting there's a real power system out there and real customers who want their power, you know, 24/7, 365. And these, the mandates in 2136 here will make it much more difficult to do that. And what I pointed out to you was, first of all, after 2007, Senate Bill 838, Energy Trust of Oregon was told to get out of big projects and focus just on small projects. And we are paying for that through the public purpose charge, 3% surcharge on our bills. And Energy Trust has a very dedicated staff, and they spend quite a bit of money every year trying to promote these projects. And what I show you in my testimony is, yes, they're spending a lot of money, but a lot of it goes to feasibility studies. In the period, if you don't have your report yet from the legislative report that occurs every 2 years, legislative report to the Assembly on public purpose charge expenditures, you will have it soon. What they show is, and that's appended to my testimony, 160 feasibility projects, feasibility analyses. Well, those were just studies. We, the public, paid for them. Those were just studies. Mm-hmm. As far as what actually was produced in this very risky field, in which a lot of feasibility studies don't lead to any power, in the last, between January of 2015 and June 30 of 2016, Energy Trust of Oregon spent $26.9 million of our money, produced 4.77 average megawatts. There were 160 feasibility studies, 2,575 completed projects. More than 99% of them were standard solar rooftop projects, which generate de minimis levels of power. And of course, all those solar projects, those are intermittent power projects. Intermittent power, whether it's wind or solar, is not really an asset to the grid. It's a liability. The grid needs steady power. And of all those 2,575, there were only 9 projects, 5 biopower and 4 hydro, that produced 62% of all the electrical output. Well, those are probably good projects. Those are probably worth subsidizing because they're producing steady electricity. All the rest, intermittent, you know, a lot of money is being thrown, very little power is being generated, and most of the power is randomly failing 70% of the time. So I'm just saying, when you go down this road to juicing this more and having more and more of the small power, the due diligence you need to put in is severe. This is very risky financially. And I just say, here's a little thought exercise. If you're looking for something in your retirement portfolio to generate some money down the line, if you looked at all these projects, how many would you personally invest in because you think it would be a good idea? And if you think they're all too risky for you, then they're too risky for all the ratepayers. You're going to make pay for this, and you're also going to make the grid less stable. So before you ramp up this requirement, think carefully, because I personally think you should ramp it down or eliminate it. You're making life for the people who have to actually provide electricity riskier and more expensive.
Thank you. Bob, do you want to go next?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm executive director of the Citizens Utility Board. I want to do three things pretty quickly today. Unfortunately, I do have to leave. I've got a board of directors meeting tonight, and that's the one meeting I have a month that's mandatory for my presence to be there. So, but I want to do three things real quick. One, just give you a quick update from my perspective on the implementation of 1547, and then talk a little bit about the two bills that are before us today. Last year, I testified, lobbied, and spent spent a fair amount of time in this building in support of Senate Bill 1547. It was a major piece of legislation. It phased out the use of coal in Oregon and doubled our RPS requirements for the two utilities that have a significant amount of coal. This year, quite frankly, I'm hoping to spend less time in this building, and it's not have anything to do with you folks. It's because I created an awful lot of work for myself by lobbying for 1547. The amount of work that is going on to implementing that is immense. It's overwhelming. Right now, we're involved in dockets dealing with the EV plans. The electric vehicle stuff is a small piece of that bill. It was a visionary piece. People around the country are looking at how Oregon implements that. I've had two out-of-state speaking engagements about what's happening in Oregon on that bill. But I have to deal with it for each of the three utilities. Each of the utilities have their own EV plans. I have ones for all three investor-owned utilities. Community solar is a new program in Oregon that bill requires. We're under a quick timeline to get rules out of that. Once we get rules out of that, we'll then have dockets for each of the two utilities or each of the three IOUs, and I'll again have to get involved in all of those. We'll spend a lot of time on competitive procurement. The PUC's open to rulemaking and to look at our competitive bidding guidelines, and that's really important because we, with the 50% RPS, we want to acquire those resources at the least cost possible for customers. We want to make this affordable. I promised the legislature a year ago that we could do this affordably, and that's part of how we're going to do it. It's also one of the ways that community renewables and other folks can have a level playing field, and they can bid in resources. And if those resources can compete on price, those resources can be chosen. So we want to make the competitive procurement work so it's not just utility projects that are being built. The IRPs, utility integrated resource plans, had to change to adapt to these new requirements. And so I'm knee-deep in the IRPs for the two utilities. And then finally, for PacifiCorp, which has its multi-state process, PacifiCorp allocates its costs across its region. It's a six-state utility. When Department of Energy was talking about, they were talking about us 25%. We get 25% of the costs of projects in Utah and Wyoming. They also, we only get paid 25% of the costs of resources here. So you've got things divided up that way. Because we're taking coal out of the mix in Oregon, that's reopened up the whole process. And how do you allocate those costs? Because obviously Oregon's not taking those. Something is being, we have to deal with the other states in that. So we've opened up a new process to deal with how the costs across PacifiCorp system are allocated. So overall, we have our hands full quite a bit full. I'm quite overwhelmed, but that's okay. I knew what I was getting into when we passed major legislation. Generally, I don't intend to ask you for very much. I do think House Bill 2133 is a relatively small bill that's a technical fix. It was always meant to be part of the small-scale community. That's why the biomass was there, and this is the same limit that applies to everyone else. So for me, this is just a very straightforward bill. With regard to 2136, that one I have larger concerns with for a couple reasons. One, when we did the modeling on the cost of the RPS and expanding the RPS, that was really looking at utility-scale projects. That was looking at trying to utilize our transmission assets. I'll give you two examples. PacifiCorp customers have transmission rights, firm transmission rights from Oregon to eastern Wyoming, where we have coal plants. As we phase out those coal plants, that is great wind, wonderful wind. Wind blow. I mean, if you've ever driven across Wyoming, you know the wind resource that's there. Customers ought to be able to use the value of that transmission asset that we paid for and bring some of that wind. And that wind has a better capacity factor than Oregon wind. And more importantly, it blows at a different time. Diversity counts in renewable resources. Why do we want the idea of limiting ourselves to local renewable resources is great for economic development, for customer rates, for making the grid work. We want to have a broader path. And if we can bring in some of that Wyoming wind through transmission assets that we've already paid for, we should do that. The same thing with Idaho Power customers. They have transmission rights to North Valmy in Nevada. Nevada is a great solar resource. Why would we not want to be able to use those transmission assets for Idaho Power's customers in eastern Oregon to be able to bring in some of those? So we want to make sure that we're using those assets right. That's what's going to keep the cost down and keep us from tripping that cost cap. If we trip the cost cap under the RPS, then the RPS gets suspended and we don't get any of that. And then the final reason I wanted to say is really an issue of fairness. We're dealing with two utilities here. here, PG&E and PacifiCorp. And I understand a lot of the reason for community renewables is economic development. And I think that's important. We need to build our state. We need to build our economy. But that ought to be a statewide responsibility, not just a responsibility for two utilities. And I don't have enough of these. I can have more printed up and sent down. But I printed up. This is just a quick little graph that shows the difference in rates between a PacifiCorp PGE and then some of the publicly owned utilities that border them. And in some cases, the publicly owned utilities are half as much. They have access to federal hydropower, which is a wonderful, cheap resource. I wish I had more access to it. But that's a historic decision. That's where we are today. But there's a competitive issue here. We're starting to reach the division in between these rates that we are in the late 70s. And that caused a destabilization that led to the Northwest Power Act. When one community has 5-cent rates, the community next to it has 10-cent rates, that has an effect on economic development. That has an effect on those communities, and we're in that kind of circumstance right now. So I do worry about if we want to build up, do more to build up community renewables from what's in currently in the law. I would suggest that we try to come up with a statewide policy and apply that fairly across all regions. PG customers should do their share. So should EWEB customers. So should everyone. And we should figure out what do we want to do, and then we should allocate that fairly across the state if we want to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions for Bob before he has to go? Representative Barker.
Thank you. Just very quickly, I'm aware from my own experience that a number of the public utilities charge very significant basic connection charges per month,
right,
compared to PGE and Pacific Power that charge $10. I think in order for this chart to be useful, you have to know what those basic charges are as well.
This charge is actually taking the revenue requirement and dividing it by the number of kilowatt hours to those customers. So it includes the customer charge. It's both the fixed and the monthly charges.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Any further questions? Okay.
Thanks, Bob. Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, here today representing Portland General Electric. Just because we have some new members of the committee, just to let folks know, Portland General Electric is the investor-owned utility that serves electrical customers basically from the ski resorts on Mount Hood to about halfway through the Coast Range, from the Columbia River to just south of the Capitol here in Salem, with the note that some of that land mass is Pacific Power service territory, and some of it is also consumer-owned utility service territory. With that, we have about 840,000 meters, and you could figure out number of customers, individuals who we serve is much larger than that 840,000 number. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 2136. Like Bob, we have some concerns in terms of the cost of this bill. We have some concerns of the fairness, and then we have some concerns on the technical aspects around 2136. But first, I want to talk a little bit about what we do, or frankly, what PGE customers do to support small-scale renewable energy development, because I think it's important as we have this conversation that we start from a point of what is the status quo policy before we start to look at advancing new policies. First, we have a federal purchasing requirement that is a must-take requirement if renewable energy projects below 20 megawatts can hit a certain price threshold, which is set by the Public Utility Commission, and that's called PURPA. We have contracts signed and executed for about 350 megawatts of these small must-take federally regulated projects. We have an interconnection queue with about another 300 megawatts of proposed PURPA projects. If all of these came online, it would be more sub 20 megawatt renewable projects than our Boardman coal facility, which is going to stop coal-fired operations at the end of 2021. So we think that's a fairly significant number that's working its way through the queue. Keep in mind the 8% mandate is a 2025 mandate. That's got a little shorter from last year. 8 years from where we are right now. Year change. Second thing we do for small is we support rooftop solar through net metering policies, which I'm sure this committee will have an opportunity to talk about at some point this year. We support community solar, which was a part of Senate Bill 1547, the Oregon Clean Electricity Coal Transition Plan, more colloquially known as Coal to Clean. Community solar was a part of that so that people who don't have suitable roofs for net metering or rooftop solar can buy into solar, which is a small renewable. Our customers fund the public purpose charge. Since 1999, the public purpose charge has been a surcharge on investor-owned utility customers' bills that goes towards energy efficiency, and some portion of it goes to the above-market cost of renewable energy. Right now, for PGE customers in 2017, our customers are going to be paying about $97 million to the Energy Trust of Oregon, which is not an insignificant expense. It starts to approach about 7% in total between 1149 and Senate Bill 838, two pieces of the public purpose charge for residential customers. We also have competitive procurement to buy renewables. If a renewables project is cost effective, it should be able to compete in a competitive solicitation. We believe that competition, when we do the acquisition of assets, is the least cost way to purchase the projects that we need to generate power for our folks. And then lastly, when we talk about communities and what we do to support communities, we are a significant property taxpayer and right-of-way taxpayer in the state of Oregon. For PGE, we pay about $55 million a year in property taxes in the state, and we pay about $45 million a year in right-of-way or franchise fees or taxes to local communities. I list all these things because I want to say we do support local communities. We do support small-scale renewables. That doesn't mean that we're also in support of House Bill 2136. So 3 points. One on the cost cap, what folks have already said. We are concerned that even at a 1% increase, some of the numbers that Brian gave earlier, we have a 4% overall cost cap on the totality of the renewable portfolio standard. We did the modeling last year on Senate Bill 1547, and we said that we believe we could stay underneath the cost cap. We did not do that modeling assuming that a third of the RPS requirement was going to come from small projects. We understand the price is coming down overall for all projects. We think that's a great trend line. We're hoping to reap the benefits of that. We are very concerned that if this bill passes, we will trigger the cost cap, and that will result ultimately in fewer renewables that we're able to develop in an affordable way. Second thing we're worried about is the fairness of this. I think one of the things, Representative Helm, Chair Helm, to your question earlier about the trade-off in terms of cost and benefit for some of these projects, the one thing I would note is if you're not an IOU customer, you would only potentially reap the benefit in that question. I think not all payers or electricity customers in the state of Oregon would be participating in this program. Folks who are in a consumer-owned service territory would not be obligated under this, under House Bill 2136. So if you were in a rural co-op, in a COU, you may see some of the benefits from some of this project development while not also bearing the cost. I mean, I would ask as a PGE customer, why is this a responsibility of developing these projects for my customers, for me, for my neighbors, and not the folks who live in Canby or Forest Grove or somewhere that's outside of investor-owned utility service territory? And then finally, we've got technical concerns about this bill. As Bob was stating earlier, we believe we can go to 50% renewable energy and keep the grid in balance. We testified on that last year. We did a lot of modeling around it. It's not going to be easy. We have challenges with capacity, basically our ability to keep the lights on, where we've got to replace a number of retiring fossil fuel facilities, not the least of which is Boardman 2021. And we've got concerns about how we get the resources to match up with our system. Early in my career working in energy, I remember looking at real-life Met Tower data from Oregon facilities and Montana facilities. You realize when you average them out, you get about a flat line. If we are only building Oregon facilities for our renewables, we will have a tremendous problem keeping the grid in balance and being able to hit that 50% renewables target that we spelled out. Without having the integrated resource plan, which is, we believe, the gold standard in planning, we're happy to talk with you about that. as we go forward, without having that inform the process for procuring renewables, as this bill would not have the IRP process inform that, we're very concerned about what this does for our ability to meet the 50%, to be able to keep our grid in balance and be able to provide power for our customers. And then finally, I don't dispute some of the folks who said that the prices are falling. A 10% delta, however, between a smaller facility and a large facility, that ends up, if you start racking up cumulative 10% deltas, that can get pretty expensive. And then ultimately what we're concerned about is, as we see the projects coming to us in the PURPA queue, we're seeing a lot of solar. We're not seeing the irrigation canal projects. We're not seeing those types of projects that have other benefits to them coming forward and hitting those cost marks. What we're worried about a little bit is that, you know, I think there's a conversation to be had about how do we incentivize those projects, how do we make sure that those are getting built. We agree with some of the presentation earlier. These are good projects. I'm not sure with this policy you're going to get more of those projects as opposed to a different type of generation that's going to hit a lower cost mark. Thank you.
Right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Annette Price, the Director of Government Affairs for Pacific Power. And for us, we serve over 565,000 customers in what we would think are the most beautiful parts of the state of Oregon, up in eastern Oregon, down the coast, in northeast Portland, as well as Klamath, Medford, Josephine County, Jackson, Josephine County. I'm here today, however, to oppose House Bill 2136 as introduced. I will not repeat what my colleagues before me have opined, simply to sum it in the sense of we have concerns about the cost, the fairness, the technical aspects of the bill. And to be clear, in respect to, we'll work with a lot of county commissioners throughout this state, and we share their concern about the economic viability of their rural economies. We live there too, and it is important to us to, as we have, invest in those economies as we have for a long, long time. Back in March of 2016, the Oregon Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Bill became law, and it charted a careful balance for carbon reduction for the state's largest electricity providers while managing costs in an equitable fashion for our customers. The law also removes, as you have heard, coal-fired electrical generation from the state's power mix for Pacific Power by 2030 and directs at least 50% of electricity of each company to be made by renewable resources by 2040. Currently, we have been hard at work to achieve this goal, and yet the bill is introduced, potentially will upend that careful balance by requiring the customers of our company to shoulder more than its share of the small-scale renewable projects as it has defined, whether we need the additional generation or not. And to put a finer point on that, while Pacific Power serves roughly about a quarter of the utility customers in the state, our customers share about half of the renewable portfolio standard goal is being made on, by our customers. So quarter of the customer base, half of the renewable portfolio standard projects in the state and the goal. So as we look ahead, we are committed to continuing our efforts to build more renewables as we have worked on last year. We just believe that House Bill 2136 isn't the right approach in doing that. And so I am more than happy to answer any questions and if you're needing any more information about our company, because I know we have some new members of this committee, and while we may have met with you briefly before, we're more than happy to follow up with you. Thank you.
Thank you all. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate your input. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about this.
Terrific. Thank you.
And due to the excellent time management of our panels, we now have time to get to the next bill. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2136 and open a public hearing on 2133. Bob had to go, so that leaves Ricky Seguin and Varner. You're going to come on back. And I believe John, were you going to testify on this one too? Okay, very good. Thank you. All right.
Cold.
Well, got a whole. You got a whole 12 minutes. That's kind of more than I expected. So let me preface this as, and for the committee, we have a bill is introduced, and I understand there's been an amendment requested. So I'm going to invite you to talk about both today so that when we end today, we know where we stand with respect to proposals about the language for this bill.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. I won't define again who that is. So we've talked, I'll give a little bit of the background in terms of how we got to NEAT 2133, and then I think Ricky will talk some about the specific amendment language and what the bill does. So as was discussed earlier today, there was originally an 8% small-scale renewable energy goal in statute from 2007 until 2016. In the bill that we've been talking about, Senate Bill 1547, the Oregon Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Plan, in the small-scale renewables section, Section 14 of that piece of legislation, there were a few different changes that were made. There were four changes. One was a change in what utilities were covered under the small-scale renewables target. Originally, it was all utilities in the state and state agencies. That changed to being two utilities in the state, PGE and Pacific Power. The second was it changed from being a goal to being a mandate. The third is we changed from energy as the calculation for the goal to nameplate capacity or aggregate electrical capacity, which are interchangeable terms, being the benchmark for the mandate. And then finally, biomass was allowed in as a fully eligible resource for the first time, considered to be a renewable portfolio standard eligible resource. That was included in the overall Bill 1547 and also included in the small-scale renewables portion. Biomass, prior to this legislation, was going to be an eligible resource, I think, in 2026, and it moved up the effective date. At the 11th hour, as we were working on the final passage of the bill, we had two final amendments as we were proceeding to the House Rules Committee, and what we realized was there was a little bit of a drafting error, and biomass was allowed in. There was no cap on how large a biomass facility could be, but we had intended to have a cap on how much output from a single biomass facility could be eligible for the small-scale renewables part of the bill. So, for instance, if you had a 100-megawatt biomass facility, only the first 20 megawatts were intended to be able to count. We realized late that there was a drafting error, that we needed to go fix it. We didn't have time at that point in the session. Here in the second week of session, it seems so leisurely compared with what happens in the last week of a short session. A group of us sat in a room, Representative Johnson, Representative or Chair Jessica Vega Peterson, former chair of this committee, Senator Edwards, and Senator Beyer, along with Oregon Forest Industries Council, representatives of CREA, myself, and Annette Price with Pacific Power. And we agreed that we would go ahead with the language as it was, but we pledged to come back and fix that drafting error in the 2017 session. The bill that you have in front of you, 2133, is essentially that fix to make sure that not all biomass counts above the first 20 megawatts of output from a biomass facility.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Ricky Seguin. I work with Renewable Northwest. We're a regional renewable energy advocacy organization. And forgive me, I'm losing my voice, so bear with me. Agree with everything Varner said. The intention of House Bill 2133 is to come back and honor the commitment that we made to cap the contribution from biomass cogeneration facilities. I wanted to speak to the amendment that I understand is being drafted, because the language as is currently written in House Bill 2133 doesn't fully accomplish what we're intending to do. As we've discussed, the 8% small-scale requirement is a capacity requirement, aggregate capacity of the two utilities. But you'll see in Section 3 of House Bill 2133, it starts out by saying electricity generated by, and the cap for these biomass cogen facilities is on average megawatts of electricity generated. So you're mixing capacity with electricity, and those units are not the same, which renders this not actually functional at capping those facilities. So we've requested an amendment that would use capacity language, 20 megawatts of capacity, regardless of the facility's nameplate capacity, would count toward the 8% requirement. So the amendment is intended to be a small technical fix to clarify the units for meeting the 8% requirement. And I'm happy to take questions. I understand that gets a little technical there, but it's really just intended to be a technical fix on units.
Thank you very much. And for the benefit of the committee, Beth and I were both informed that the amendment would be coming. The first try at the amendment didn't get the language right, and so we're still awaiting the revised language. And so that will be posted as soon as Beth gets it. So. We just, the hearing and the amendment have not crossed paths appropriately yet, but we will get that done. Any questions from the committee for our panelists? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate both of your testimony about trying to correct oversights in the fog of February, which happens frequently, unfortunately. So yes, this was something that we planned on doing as we got to the session, but I just wondered if either one of you might clarify the rumor that I've heard that your amendment will also recognize wood-fired pizza as biomass cogen facilities.
We'll wait to see the amendment language.
Thank you. Chair Helm, members of the committee, PGE takes a strong position against white sauces on pizza or the inclusion of pineapple in pizza.
There you go, pineapple.
Careful.
Thank you.
We represent a diverse group of pizza lovers.
Headline in the Oregonian tomorrow.
No. Any further questions for our panel? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you have no problem with the amendment being proposed?
Chair Helm, Representative Brock Smith, that's correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, very good. Thank you very much, and stay tuned for the amendment, folks, on OLIS.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing for now on 2133 and close the committee here. Close the committee here.